Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Joe Berlinger, who, along with Bruce Sanofsky, are a team of American documentary filmmakers who gained critical acclaim and cult fame since their debut crime film, Brother's Keeper. Their latest film, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, will premiere on HBO Thursday night. It is the third film in a series originally intended to be a movie about three guilty teenagers on trial for murder. Sanofsky and Berlinger soon realized that their film Paradise Lost, which chronicled the murder of 3 8-year-old boys in rural Arkansas, eventually became more about the fear and panic of Satanism along with questionable police work that led to the arrest and conviction of 3 teenagers known as the West Memphis Three. Berlinger and Sanofsky also made the film on the rock band Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, and Joe Berlinger directed the feature documentary Crude. And also joining us in the studio is Jason Baldwin, one of the West Memphis Three. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, glad to be here.
And beginning with you, Joe, this has been 20 years of your life, Jason, in jail.
Right.
But it's also, for a filmmaker, it's unusual.
It's been 2 decades.
Two decades.
Yeah. And you know, as you mentioned in your intro, we were sent an article right after these guys were arrested by Sheila Nevins at HBO, and the article, you know, we didn't realize at the time just how one-sided the press reports coming out of Arkansas were, and it just seemed like an open and shut case, according to the press, of bad guys, you know, horrible teenagers worshiping the devil, killing 3 8-year-olds. And one of the great ironies of this two-decade, three-film odyssey of advocating for their release and their innocence is that we went down to Arkansas back in June of 93, a few days after the arrest, thinking we were making a film about bad guys, you know, kind of a real life River's Edge, that 1986 movie by Tim Hunter about, you know, disaffected youth. And you know, the first couple of months we were down there, we primarily spent with the parents of the victims, had no reason necessarily to believe that we still weren't making a film about guilty teenagers. But the moment we met these guys and did our first interviews, just, you know, red flags started going up. And we realized that these guys, we came to realize, I can't say it was like an immediate, oh my God, because that would be irresponsible to just make a decision like that. But it just didn't seem that these guys had committed the crime. And the more we dug into it, the more we realized that this was, you know, a rush to judgment and that these guys were innocent.
Well, Jason Baldwin, you were arrested as a teenager.
Right. I was 16 years old, and they arrested me on my last day of school for the 10th grade.
And you came out as a 35-year-old man, is that right?
In April, I'll be 35, yeah. Close enough, right?
That's a lot of time and obviously a deep injustice. And, of course, the bitter irony was that in order for you to get out of jail, you had to plead guilty to a crime for which you were innocent.
Right. They said I can maintain my innocence and keep standing on that, but at the same time, I had to accept the state's assertion that they have guilty people,
right?
Which really doesn't make sense at all, no matter how you look at it. But it was the only opportunity I was presented with to save Damien's life for certain, you know, to get him off death row in that horrible, horrible place he was in. Of course, where I was at wasn't a picnic either, but it wasn't nearly as bad as where he was.
Right, and it foreclosed the possibility of a trial at which the state knew you'd be acquitted,
exactly.
And then you'd be able to turn around and sue them for damages for
Correct.
Taking so many years off your life.
Right. Yeah, I think that was their main line of reasoning, which I can understand them wanting to save the state money for upcoming hearings and a possible trial and wanting to get a quick, finally, a quick, you know, ending to all this. However, what I don't understand is the fact that they made us take the Alford plea. What they should have done is dropped all charges, said, you know, it was erroneous from the start. We had new people in power, you know, Scott Englund, new judge, David Lacer. So wouldn't any fault and blame be on them. However, they still had the looming, had to deal with the contention of a lawsuit for false imprisonment. So I think that was the only thing that they were being permitted to pursue. But it flies in the face of, you know, their oaths as public servants, you know, to uphold the law and protect justice and the innocent. And this deal did not do that in any way, because it leaves the case closed for finding who really murdered those boys. And that's the true tragedy.
And does anyone, you know, it's just illogical. Does anyone really think that the state of Arkansas, that these officials would if they really in their hearts believed that these three teenagers took 3 8-year-olds out into the woods and slaughtered them in a devil-worshipping ritual, as they allege, does anyone really think that they would release them, you know, vacate the death penalty sentence, vacate the life without parole sentence, and release them if they really believe that they were guilty? And if they really do believe that they're guilty and they release them under those circumstances, shame on the state of Arkansas. But I say shame on the state of Arkansas for making these guys plead guilty to a crime that they didn't commit, just to end this nightmare of 18 years of false imprisonment.
And just apropos the idea that the guilty person is still out there, the film makes a fairly strong case that there is somebody that is very likely to be guilty. In the DNA evidence that was exculpatory, there was a hair found on the bindings on the boys that traced to the stepfather of one of the murdered boys.
Yeah.
And you've gotten amazing footage that you've been able to show us of him being deposed in a different matter where he actually sued one of the Dixie Chicks, right? So walk
strange,
us through that.
Strange. Well, you know, I would hate to do to Mr. Hobbs, who's the stepfather of murder victim Stephen Branch, I would hate to do to him what was done to the West Memphis Three and definitively say, oh, he's the killer. You know, the point of that in the film is that there's extremely exculpatory, all the DNA evidence points away from the West Memphis Three. Not a shred of DNA has been found linking these guys to the crime. And in a crime as grisly as this, as they allege, you would think that there would be DNA somewhere. The one piece of DNA is a hair that was found in the ligature, in the shoelace, you know, because these boys were bound hand to foot, you know, in a hog-tied fashion, in the ligature of one of the boys' shoelaces, Michael Moore, was found a hair consistent with Terry Hobbs, but also consistent with 1.5% of the population. So it's not open and shut definitive proof, but the point of it is that in this country, when people are convicted of a capital crime, which means death row or life without parole, the measure of the law, the jury is instructed to find that verdict beyond all reasonable doubt. And when you have such alarming DNA evidence that points to somebody else and points away from the West Memphis Three, that is something that needs to be looked into. And of course, with this Alford plea, the state is officially saying the case is closed, that the guilty people have served time, and that is an affront to anybody who's interested in justice, and particularly an affront to the parents of the victims who are being told, we're not going to find who the real killer is.
But it also points, surely, Joe Burlinger, to the notion that the police work was so poor in the first place to have arrived at this railroaded verdict. And they didn't bother to look into this guy who had a violent past.
Oh, my God.
And he shot his brother-in-law or somebody, didn't he? Yeah.
There was an altercation with his brother that resulted in a stomach wound that ended up killing the, you know, killing the brother.
That's not an everyday
right, no, of course not. I mean, you know, statistically, child homicides are overwhelmingly done by parents or guardians or somebody who knew the child very well. That is just a statistical fact. And so therefore, the police not even interviewing this stepfather at the time of the arrests, or at the time of the crimes, rather, is just emblematic of the tunnel vision they had. You know, Damien Echols, you know, was a different kid. He wore a long black trench coat in the summer, allegedly, and the juvenile officers were already sending his drawings and writings to a bogus satanic expert a year before the crimes even took place. I mean, they had it in. They were going to find a crime to pin on this guy. And unfortunately, Jason was friends with Damien, and so it was guilt by association. But it does. It's, you know, the police work in this case was shockingly inferior.
And tell me, though, Joe Bellinger, it's not explicit in the film in any way, but it's just something that I felt about the film, about the atmospherics, is that the leap to Satanism, you know, when in fact the bodies of these boys were mauled by animals in the forest, which is incredibly common when they find bodies, you know, that the foxes and the coyotes and whatever have mauled them. That's, you know, you see CSI films on TV, it's half the time it's about that. So that's amazing that never occurred to the prosecutors and the police. But the Satanism with that bogus mail-ordered PhD guy, Is that fueled by kind of Christian fundamentalism, which is, I think, pretty prevalent in Arkansas is a red state?
Yeah.
So give me a sense of whether there is that sort of sense of piety there that drove this kind of delusion.
Well, you know, being a New York Jew, I don't want to bust on Christians here, but, I think it's a little more complex than that in the sense that this entire country had, in the late 80s, early 90s, was swept up in this satanic hysteria. The media was inflaming it. You see it in the film. There was a 2020 news article, and it showed a map about, not article, broadcast, you know, the Satan expert, you know, shows us his interview back in 1985, and there's a map about all this different states. But the reality is the FBI in 92 said, you know, we cannot connect a single homicide, a single child homicide with satanic activity, and that this is just a bogus thing that police experts who then go advise police departments are just making hay off of, you know, earning a living and creating this fake hysteria. So I think this was a nationally prevalent thing, but I think where the Christian fundamentalism comes in, and with all due respect to that region, I think this was a part of the world where, first of all, people, you know, if you literally believe in heaven and hell, and if you believe in Jesus, then and you believe in the devil, and therefore I think people felt that it was, this crazy story was plausible. But I don't even, you know, I don't want to make it a religious thing, because I think the other thing that I observed down there in this part of the world, you know, I think people in Arkansas and other places, you know, believed in their authority figures. They have no reason to question the police. And so when the police come out and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 11, and when the prosecution, you know, comes out and portrays this crazy devil-worshipping theory, the people there are as they should. You know, unfortunately, they violated the trust that was placed in them by having this crazy story. I think the combination of religious fundamentalism and the goodness of the Arkansas people who believe in their authority figures led them to buy into this story, not to mention the local media there. And that's one of the themes of this third film, because you actually see the local media reports throughout the film. The local media in the early days of this story did everything possible to inflame people's passions. They printed a confession that was completely out of context, a false confession, as we later learn, and there was no way these guys were going to get a fair trial. So the combination of the media reporting the story, people believing in their authority figures, and believing in the devil as a tangible thing, I think did help make this a reality for people.
Well, it also feels, though, that, you know, anti-intellectualism played a role here. If you had to follow the logic of the trial judge, who, when the lawyers challenged the credibility of this satanic expert who's got a mail order PhD, when they say, well, this guy, you know, ask him, understand, did you sit for any courses to get your PhD? No. And then the judge intervenes and says, well, you know, you don't have to really go to school to be an expert, you know.
I mean, you could have a third grade education.
I was astounded by that.
Look, we sat through those trials with our jaws on the ground most of the time, because we saw these guys were absolutely getting railroaded, and their musical tastes and their, their religious beliefs were on trial. I mean, Metallica lyrics were actually introduced into the trial as evidence that these guys were baby killers, which is offensive on so many levels, because since when do your musical tastes play into what your activities are? And the great irony is, you know, Metallica lyrics have nothing to do with satanic worship. They're anti-authoritarian, but it has nothing to do with devil worshiping. But the fact that Damien's love of Stephen King novels, you know, and Jason's love of Metallica were reasons that these guys should be convicted were just, you know, it was just mind-boggling to see.
So, Jason, in having spent 18 years in prison for a crime that you had nothing to do with, and having been railroaded, you know, for a really vicious, hideous crime that still remains, the guilty party still is out there. How do you make up for that time? I mean, are you bitter at all?
I think it would be a worse tragedy if I did come out of this bitter or hateful or resentful, because then that would destroy my ability to enjoy life, enjoy living, you know. I put all that behind me. I put all that to the side and just really enjoy what I'm doing right now. And I developed that practice way earlier, even when I was still in prison, because, you know, no matter where you are, no matter where you're at, you know, you can still find things about your life to enjoy. And people have just been so loving and kind and accepting to me, you know. I mean, I'm traveling around the country, around the world even, you know, and thanking people in person for their letters of support, their prayers, and any hard work and stuff they, you know, they've done to make it possible, you know, for me to be here today. And, you know, that's what I focus on, you know.
Well, the movie's about the good side and the bad side of America, right, isn't it? I mean, doesn't it come down to that in a way?
Yeah. You know, that's another reason why I kind of, like, dedicate, you know, the rest of my life to, you know, stopping things like this from happening to other people. I'm starting college in April. I hope to work towards getting a law degree and going to law school if my grades are good enough. Let's hope they are, right? And to maybe prevent something like this from happening to another teenager, or help another teenager or grown man who was a teenager, you know, get out of this, you know, in similar situations. You know, so, you know, life is a beautiful thing. Life is great. And the sad thing is tragedy and bad things happen to good people, and they happen all over the world. But what was so miraculous and spectacular is that in this case, Joe and Bruce were able to get down there and capture it on film so people could see it. And so many people came galvanized and motivated to help in any way they can, whether it's throwing gigantic, huge, cool, awesome concerts, or just writing a letter to the representatives of the state of Arkansas saying, hey, we know what you did was wrong. Fix it, you know. So
I have to say, you know, just hanging out with Jason the last couple of months, it's amazing to me how not bitter he is. I have to say, I'm not sure I would have that kind of attitude. I would be really angry and really wanting revenge, just knowing me. So I'm quite impressed with what he has done with this experience. It's obviously not a good thing that he was put in prison, but he has seen, you know, he has figured out how to, you know, get the silver lining out of it. And I have a lot of faith that we're going to be hearing from Jason quite a bit in the coming years.
Well, but you've got to feel good about what you've done, Joe, and your partner, Bruce.
Yeah, no, look, we...
You're an accidental crusader, in a sense, right? You just started to do a film.
Yeah, well, I would say we were an accidental crusader at the beginning, and then the second and third film were clearly acts of advocacy, because from a filmmaking standpoint, revisiting this grisly material again and again, you know, was not something I would choose from purely a cinematic standpoint. Look, you know, I'm in a business where you rarely see such tangible results. I had an extraordinary extreme over the last year, you know, bookended by, you know, I was sued last year by Chevron over my movie Crude, and kind of whacked over the head with, you know, with the might of the third largest corporation in America, and started questioning whether or not it was a good idea had I made Crude, because it was getting me in such hot water. And that was, you know, when you start to question whether or not you should have made a film, you know, that goes to the core of who you are. And to have it bookended, you know, I think the greatest moment I've ever had in my career, and we've been doing this for a long time now and have had some great moments, was at the New York Film Festival in October. At the end of the movie, we all stood up, meaning Jason, Jesse, and Damien Echols, me and Bruce, and Sheila Nevins from HBO, and we got this rousing standing ovation. And I know the standing, you know, it was like a 10-minute ovation, you know, maybe a half a minute was for the movie, but most of the ovation was for the situation and for these guys. And that was just one of the most touching moments that I think I've ever had in my career. So to have that happen in the same year that I got clobbered by a major corporation was, you know, was especially gratifying.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Joe Berlinger, and along with your filming partner, Bruce Sanofsky, you've made this extraordinary film, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory. It's going to premiere Thursday night on HBO, and of course, it's been a tremendous pleasure to have you, Jason Baldwin, one of the West Memphis Three, in the studio with us here today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.